What controls our minds? Dear Lily, many of us believe that we think what we like, even if we may have to be careful in what we say. This is an illusion. From the moment we are born, our minds are being molded to think in particular ways, to see certain objects, to make certain connections, to establish particular patterns, to value specific things. Other things around us are invisible, unregistered, unvalued. This set of filters influences the way in which I write to you and you read or listen to these letters and talks. It also shapes the way in which readers and listeners in other parts of the world, whose mental spectacles are very different from English ones, will understand or disagree with what I am writing. Time flies like an arrow, or does it? In most human societies, time has not been seen as a straight line. It's usually been thought of as circular, reflecting our normal experience. In plants and animals, there is birth, maturation, aging, death, perhaps rebirth. So it is with the days and nights and with the seasons of the year. Time does not advance. It is not split into tiny fragments. Its rhythm is slow and repetitive. It is not independent of us. The very movement of the stars in the sky declares that motion is circular. And we know from our experience that time feels elastic, sometimes passing too fast or too slowly. The posh name for this is relativity. As Albert Einstein explained, when you are courting a nice girl, an hour seems like a second. When you sit on a red-hot cinder, a second seems like an hour. That's relativity. Yet you and I treat time in a more mechanical way, and no one is sure why we now have this peculiar attitude to time. We not only subdivide it into tiny fractions, but look on it as a scarce commodity, draining away, to be saved or spent. It is also thought to be going somewhere, aiming towards some future event, like a river or an arrow, and it ticks away, irrespective of how we feel about it. We are not like the nomadic Arabs who knew that it was autumn when they came upon a valley with a certain kind of mushroom growing in it. We know when it is autumn and go to that valley specifically to collect the mushrooms. Except in the jokes about confused tourists who wake up and say to themselves, "We are in Tokyo, it must be Thursday." We tend first to think of time and then arrange our lives around it. There are several theories to explain our obsession, our battling with time. There's a religious element. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam seem to have an idea of time as a progression or straight line. This is very different from the secular concepts of Hinduism or the annihilation of past and future in certain forms of Buddhism, This particular thread was given heavy emphasis when Protestantism emerged in the 16th century. From then, God was particularly concerned that we did not waste time or our talents. Accounting for what we do, making every moment count, turning time into profitable activity, were strongly encouraged. Time had been thought of in all previous civilizations as reflecting the circular rhythms of nature. Sundials and gravity clocks using sand or water were the only ones that existed until the 10th century. Then something strange happened, which set time free. A device was developed, the escapement as it's called, that broke the continuous motion of gravity into little equal parts. It rotated back and forth regularly, like the tick-tock, tick-tock of a clock. There is disagreement as to whether it was invented in China or the West, but certainly it was in the West that it was rapidly developed. It is also argued that the regular enclosed rhythms of the monastic orders, with their bells and tight time schedules, required such a precise clock to be developed. In other words, a new sense of time accounting was already present before the mechanical clock was invented. Others suggest the opposite. They say that it was the new clocks, available from the 12th century, that gave us a more exact sense of time. Whatever the answers to these questions of cause and origin, it's not difficult to see how much we are obsessed and ruled by time. We learn to internalize it, to fear or fight against it, to think of it as a commodity to consume. Even with the spread of mobile phones, a recent check I made among my students suggested that the watch is still the most common machine we carry around with us. We can now imagine microscopic slices of time, microseconds and even nanoseconds. Our attention spans have shrunk and our civilization ticks to the clock and whirs with ever faster travel and computers. Do we look to the past or to the future? In most traditional societies, people tended to look to the past. They revered their ancestors, tried to retain the traditions, lived in a remembered world. In contrast, increasingly for us, the past is a foreign country where strangers lived. Most people, especially in rapidly changing societies like America or China, tend to think much more about the present, and particularly the future, than about the past. They see little or no connection between themselves and previous generations. The threads are cut. They have nothing in common with the landscape they live in except as heritage. Science fiction rather than historical fact interests them. Again, it's difficult to know why this great change has taken place. Its roots are partly religious and philosophical. Most religions have had their great moment in the past, in the life of the Buddha, Muhammad, the prophets, or Confucius. Christianity, however, looks forward to the second coming. Like communism, it is a utopian faith, travelling hopefully towards a world where all sin and misery will be cleansed from earth. Technology also plays a part. Rapid change cuts us off from the past. The great inventions of printing, the compass, and gunpowder meant that the 17th century philosophers felt that they were no longer in the same world as that of their ancient forebears. They were no longer living in a circular world, for there was real progress. Now we often feel that those who lived before electricity, cars, photography, and modern medicine must have been very different. Technological change is so rapid that a world before the internet, the mobile phone, genetic engineering, and the latest generation of weapons seems a different one, with little to teach us. Societies based on the premise of the hierarchy of caste tend to emphasize links with the past. Previous events explain and justify present inequalities. Noble families treasure their family trees and pay respect to their ancestors. Even ordinary families maintain their position by attention to past origins. When a new world was created in the United States based on equality at birth, at least for white people, the interest in the past was cut off in one stroke. We ourselves make our own way in life. What our family was or did in the past is largely irrelevant, or just a leisure interest, as in the great interest in family genealogy. Live for the future. Make and remake your world is the view of many. The majority of white populations, of the white population of America, only arrived relatively recently. Yet its citizens hope and sometimes believe it has a great future. I remember my surprise on my first visit as I passed through customs in America, and instead of being asked, "How are you?" or, as I would have been in my Nepalese village, "Have you eaten rice?" I was greeted with a cheerful, "Have a good day," with the day ahead stretched invitingly in front of us. Why does money matter so much? "Time is money," is an old saying, showing the connection between two of our obsessions. What then is money, this strange thing which, like time, consumes much of our attention and dominates our lives to such an extent? Money is a trick or a fiction. It is a symbol which has no intrinsic value. gold, silver, jewels, bits of paper or cowrie shells are in themselves useless and valueless. Value is injected into them by humans. This explains why almost anything can be used as money. At school, money was sometimes marbles, sometimes white mice, sometimes sweets. In many parts of Asia, tea blocks are still used as money. They are in many ways a good form of money, since they can at least be boiled up and drunk in an emergency. In others, salt, pepper, or spices are used, or precious incense. These items seem to have intrinsic value, not merely something injected into them. Whatever form it takes, it turns into full-blown money when the object can simultaneously be a store and measure of value and an item of exchange. It is our attitude that determines its value. Hence, it is not money itself that is said to be the root of all evil, but, according to the Bible, the love of money. Money stands for a relation of power over others. It is like oil in a machine, for it allows the parts to function without grinding against each other. It is a translation device, a leveler. It makes objects in different spheres exchangeable. It allows us, having created one commodity, then to exchange this for another. It has no morality, no inner essence, but it can enter almost all of our life. We do try to protect specific areas with visible signs. No money here. Certain beautiful things are beyond the reach of money. I cannot sell King's College or even the 100th part that I appear to own as a fellow of the college. I cannot buy or sell love or friendship. I cannot buy or sell truth or religious salvation, although the Catholic Church did at one time sell indulgences. I cannot buy part of the public park in the centre of Cambridge. I cannot buy a ticket in a cricket team or an orchestra or a chance to study at King's College. Yet in much of our life, money holds us to ransom. It slips through our hand in a slithery way. The more we have, the more we seem to need. Few people admit to having too much, and many have less than they need or want. Indeed, much of our capitalist world is propelled by an apparently unavoidable shortage of money. This is created by the desire for the substance itself. It seems, as in many fairy stories, to turn into dust when it is touched. In comparison with most of the planet, in Britain we are immensely affluent or rich. Our world is awash with the things that money can buy. Yet few of us feel satisfied. At the other extreme, there are some simple societies where people wander about in forests and savannas. They appear to have hardly anything at all. Yet it is reported that they often feel satisfied with their lives. The paradox arises from the fact that satisfaction comes from the relation between means and ends, income and expenditure. This was immortally put by Mr. Micawber in David Copperfield by Charles Dickens. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £19, £19 and £6. Result, happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £20, £0 and £6. Result, misery. Some simple hunting and gathering societies have a finite need for food and water, for shelter and clothing, and for leisure and social relationships. There is more than enough of all of these. Income exceeds demand. We, on the other hand, often reach for the stars, have an open-ended demand, and a deep craving for more and more. Very soon we forget that what made us happy yesterday would not satisfy us for a moment today. I met a Chinese man in his 30s. He said that as a country boy, all he wished for in life was one day to be rich enough to have boiled dumplings every morning, like his city cousins. Now his daughter wants a PhD from Beijing University. The revolution of rising expectations condemns many of us to eternal dissatisfaction. Buddhism calls understanding this the second noble truth. Each choice we make is a minor deprivation. At the restaurant of life, we can gorge ourselves only on a certain amount. If we choose the curry, there is sadness that the pizza or stew is untasted. The Romans made themselves vomit so that they could enjoy the taste of more food. But in the end, even they were satisfied and could not eat everything. We always want more. Happiness is seen as lying in some future bonus or better job. Yet we are constantly brainwashed to think that money really exists, and that the more we have of it, the happier we will be. The whole capitalist consumption machine would crash to the ground if we could not be persuaded to spend. The billboards, television advertisements, lifestyles of media and sporting heroes constantly shout money, money, money at us. It's therefore sensible from time to time to stand back. We can try tasting a bit of money in our mouth. It tastes, unless it is pepper or tea, of course, of nothing. Nor does it last. As the Irish philosophically put it, a shroud has no pockets. That wise economist Adam Smith pointed out that if we want to escape from the trap of anxiety and dependency on money, the thing is not to look at how we can get more money, but how to spend less. For though we can never earn enough to satisfy our ever-expanding cravings, through frugality we can learn the pleasure of being free from care. We certainly need sufficient money in the present world, and as the comedian Woody Allen observed, money is better than poverty, if only for financial reasons. We can also perhaps start to enjoy one of life's greatest delights, which is seeing how a little of the extra which we have saved can give relief and pleasure to others. For, as the philosopher Francis Bacon wrote, "Money is like manure, not good unless it be spread." How sensible are our categories? Our culture teaches us to create a grid or map of the world, placing things into boxes. Some things are alike, others are different. Those that straddle the borders are often dangerous or dirty. We believe that these things really are what we believe them to be because of their innate qualities, that apples and plums belong to one class of things, cats and dogs to another. A delightful undermining of our categories is shown by the arrangement attributed by Dr. Franz Kuhn to a Chinese encyclopedia called The Heavenly Emporium of Benevolent Knowledge. This divides animals as follows: A. Those that belong to the emperor. B. Embalmed ones. C. Those that are trained. D. Suckling pigs. E. Mermaids. F. Fabulous ones. G. Stray dogs. H. Those that are included in this classification. I. Those that tremble as if they were mad. J. Innumerable ones. K. Those drawn with a very fine camel's hair brush. L. Etc. M. Those that have just broken the flower vase. N. Those that at a distance resemble flies. The logic behind this classification is not easy to see, and we may wonder what would happen if innumerable suckling pigs became frenzied and broke a flower vase at a great distance. We might think that this Chinese example is somewhat fanciful, but the Japanese numbering system is quite similar. For each class of things, there is a different series of numbers. The ordinal numbers, and I quote here from a description, are divided into nearly as many series as there are classes of objects. There's one class for all animals, except the flying and swimming species and insects. Another for birds, in which, however, hares and rabbits are included. A third for ships and junks and boats. A fourth for liquids drunk with a glass, as water, wine, tea, etc. A fifth for things having length, as trees, pens, sticks, masts, beams, radishes, carrots, fingers, brooms, pipes, etc., and so ad infinitum. The author stopped there in despair for seeing that they would fill a volume by themselves. Yet arbitrary as these classifications look, your or my classifications would probably look just as arbitrary to a visiting spaceman. For instance, why do we classify the bottom of things as more reliable and stable and truthful than the top, so that what appears at the bottom of a television screen is more believed than what is at the top? Our mental worlds are filled with reflections of the present and past worlds which created them. These reflections in turn reshape and determine what we can think. They are instilled in us by our family, school, media, friends. Only a considerable effort makes it possible to stand back and examine what have been called the idols of the mind, the things we fall down and worship without much thought. How can we talk about the world? The difficulty of examining our mind's hidden paths is made even greater by the entrapment of language. As Rudyard Kipling rightly observed, words are, of course, the most powerful drug used by mankind. Their power is not just mental. As the Japanese proverb puts it, one kind word can warm 3 winter months. Almost everything we do and feel is affected by language. So although language does not determine our thought, it does set a grid through which we see, feel about, and report our world. The comparative linguist Benjamin Whorf wrote that we dissect nature along lines laid down by our native language. Language is not simply a reporting device for experience, but a defining framework for it. For instance, by contrasting English and Hopi, Whorf tried to show that in English, time is divisible into past, present, and future, while in Hopi, there is just a division between those things that are manifest and those that are still in the process of being manifest. There is no equivalent of past, present, and future tenses. This obviously alters our way of perceiving time. In the Japanese language, there are no tenses, no way of knowing whether something has happened, is happening, or will happen. There is no use of pronouns, so one does not know if I, you, we, or they are doing something through language. There is no positive and negative distinction, so if we invite someone to dinner and they say hi, it can mean yes or it can mean no. This is combined with many other, to us, odd features of grammar and syntax, And the fact that sets of characters, there are three such systems in Japan, can mean entirely different things. I well remember sitting for 15 minutes while a Japanese companion went through a menu with the waitress and tried to ascertain what certain dishes on it really were. When the food finally appeared, it bore little resemblance to what we thought we had ordered. It's no wonder that the Japanese have a proverb: language is a barrier to communication, and that they prefer haragai, or body language, to the spoken form. Each language has its peculiarities. English has very little grammar, but lots of words. Romance languages, the ones that come from Latin, including French, Italian, Spanish, compel us to specify the gender of all nouns. Certain American Indian languages oblige people to indicate whether an object is near or far from the speaker, and whether it is visible or invisible. It is not difficult to see why in the Himalayas there are three forms of the verb to come, meaning to come up, to come down, or to come on the flat. It's an endlessly enthralling topic. For example, can we see things for which we have no word? Among the people I work with in Nepal, the word pingya means both blue and green. Can they see the difference if they cannot speak about it? A clue to the answer is given by the fact that in Russian there are two words for blue, which roughly mean light and dark blue. A Russian anthropologist studying us might come to the logical, but I think incorrect, conclusion that because we do not linguistically differentiate the two blues, the Oxford and Cambridge boat race teams could not tell each other apart. When I asked my Nepalese friends, they said that of course they could see the difference between the green grass and the blue sky. The nature of the primary colours and the very idea of what colour is varies greatly. In China, Japan, and Korea, there are five primary colours: white, black, green-blue, yellow-red, brown-red. We do not consider white and black to be colours at all, but have a different range of primary colours, including yellow. Thinking is our strongest survival tool, and language and culture the expression of it. Yet we are constantly trapped into certain habits of the mind. Much of our world goes unnoticed, or noticed too strongly. Yet these blinkers are at least half explicit, and we are taught a little about this at school, especially if we learn other languages. Deeper and less examined are the seduction of our senses, the ways in which we absorb knowledge by apprehending reality through our body.